from the studios of KPCW in Park City. It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, we're going to be talking about bees and noise.
Yes.
First, we're going to celebrate World Bee Day, which is today, Chris. Mm. And we're going to be doing this with Daniel Reichel, who is the acting director of the Pollinator Initiative at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's going to be talking about the current state of bees and what these pollinators mean to biodiversity and human livelihoods.
Then, in the second part of the show, journalist Chris Burdock joins us to speak about his new book, Clamor, How Noise Took Over the World and How We Can Take It Back. Clamor brings attention to noise pollution, its various and growing sources, impacts to our health and well-being, and the surprising lengths people are going to reduce and avoid it. That's in the second part of the show. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Today, our first guest is in honor of World Bee Day, which is today. And I'm thrilled to announce that we have Daniel Reichel joining us. Daniel is the acting director of the Pollinator Initiative at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, all. Thanks for having me.
We are so glad to have you on the show, especially on this day. And we wanted you to first tell us a little bit about yourself and your path toward this world of pollinators.
I'm an attorney by training, and my personal path was, at one point, I think I wanted to be a novelist. But after college, I didn't write the Great American novel. And I decided if I couldn't be a struggling artist, I might as well be a struggling lawyer. So I went to law school with the idea that I wanted to do good. I fell in love with environmental law. Hmm. And, you know, the rest is history. And I started working initially on fracking issues, and then I transitioned into issues protecting our pollinators and our bees. And it's surprising the similarities there. You know, the worlds are similar in that, you know, the real threats we face are toxic pollution. Mm. And I can talk a little bit about that. But yeah, I've been doing that for about 8 years.
Well, we definitely want to get into that, the impacts that these have. But first, let's start with the basic and what a bee's role is in our ecosystems.
Yeah, so bees are hugely, hugely important. They are keystone species in our ecosystems and in our food systems. And maybe starting there, you know, one out of every three bites of food that we take comes from pollination provided by bees or other pollinators. Bees are not the only pollinators, but they're some of the most important pollinators. And they are also responsible for the production of about 70 out of 100 of the top crops in the world. So hugely, hugely important in our food systems. Outside of the grocery aisle or off of the farm fields, bees and other pollinators are responsible for something like 80% of the world's plants on the face of the earth require some form of pollinator to reproduce. So if we lose our bees, if we lose our pollinators, we worry not only about food insecurity, but also the collapse of ecosystems. And again, that's why we call bees, you know, keystone species. They're really important to holding the whole thing up.
And there are a number of different species, and probably each of these species has its own plants or places that it goes that help nourish them. What are these different species and what kind of differentiates them from one another?
Yeah, so I think when we talk about bees, we have to put them into two big categories. So when most people think about bees, they think about honeybees. Mm-hmm. Honeybees are one species of bee. They're not actually native to the United States. They were brought over from the old world. They form colonies. They make honey. You definitely have an image of a bee in your mind's eye. And they're essentially livestock in the United States. So we have beekeepers. We know approximately, you know, how many colonies we have, how many hives we have. On the other side, there are all of the native wild bees. And, you know, compared to one species of honeybee, there are 4,000 species of wild bees in North America. In Utah, there's actually 1,000 species in just Utah alone.
Wow.
Utah's a very, very bee-rich state. And these are also good crop pollinators. You know, we use honeybees to pollinate crops, but actually wild bees provide a lot of crop pollination too. And in some cases, they're better than honeybees at doing that. And they're also the bees that are deeply connected to our natural ecosystems. And you sort of mentioned it, some of these bees are very specialized to a very particular plant. So if you lose that bee, you start to lose that plant as well because it doesn't get the pollination it needs to reproduce. But some of those native bees are also generalist pollinators. So they're gonna be visiting a lot of different flowers, and bumblebees are a good example of that.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, I wanted to circle back to something you said right at the beginning. You said effectively every third bite of the food on our plate, or one third of the food on our plate, is a result of bees or pollinators, species, doing their job. We think typically of that's fruits and vegetables and things like that. But might we also say that even, say, the meat industry, the dairy industry, relies on pollinator species? I mean, cows aren't happily munching on flowers and grass out there if bees and other pollinator species aren't doing their job.
So it's the connection there is a little less strong. And so
yes.
If you noticed, I said, you know, hey, 70 out of 100 top crops, we rely on pollinators to produce, but only one out of every three bites of food. And that's because some of the biggest crops, like corn or soybean or some of the grain crops, are actually wind pollinated and not pollinated by bees and other pollinators. Although there's some studies out there that show, you know, bees can improve soybean yields. They're not essential to a number of those crops.
Okay.
So, and we eat a lot of corn and soybean and grains and other things.
Right.
So, the connection there is not as strong, but certainly with stuff like alfalfa and other things that cows munch on, there's that connection there.
Okay.
And we established how important they are to our ecosystem and to humankind, our livelihood as well. What is impacting them in terms of climate change, their habitats, maybe human interaction, and then you touched on it in the very beginning. Let's get into some of those neonics.
Yeah, so let's just start by setting the scene, and that is that bees are in trouble, and that's both honeybees and wild bees. So starting with honeybees, you know, we have numbers for honeybees, right? Because they're livestock. We don't have good numbers for wild bees, but we know about how many bee colonies there are. Year before last, we saw losses of 55% across the board. It was the worst year for beekeepers on record. And we don't have the data for last year yet, but everything that we're hearing is that last year was even worse.
Hmm.
We're talking losses maybe in the 60 to 70% range. And unfortunately, this has been sort of the scary new normal over the last 20 years ago. Before 20 years ago, beekeepers were losing maybe 10, 15% of their hives, mostly due to winter cold. And then sometime in the mid-2000s, virtually overnight, those numbers of losses shot up to 30, 40, 50%. And people started talking about colony collapse disorder. And unfortunately, those losses have sort of persisted to the present day and actually appear to be getting worse in the very recent past. So that's really scary. And there are, especially because what's happening to honeybees, you know, we know that honeybees are sort of canaries in the coal mine for what's happening to our wild bee species too. And we see more and more of those species disappearing. We see species like the rusty patch bumblebee or the American bumblebee losing 90% of their population in the last 20 years. And we know that they're also canaries in the coal mine for a much broader hollowing out of our ecosystems that we see with all sorts of insect life. So in terms of the factors affecting bees, you know, habitat loss historically has been a big one. Climate change is more and more a problem. We have parasites like varroa mites. We have pathogens like Nosema. But there's only one factor that maps really well with that sudden spike in losses of bees we saw in the mid-2000s and other pollinators. And that's the sudden uptick in use of this new class of pesticides known as the neonicotinoids, or neonics for short.
Yeah, what are they and why are they used?
So neonics are neurotoxic insecticides, which means they are pesticides designed to kill bugs by attacking their nerves. And we've had insecticides for a long time, but there are three factors that make neonics especially pernicious, and that's that they are potent, they are penetrating, and they're exceptionally popular. So to start with potency, neonics are maybe the most powerful insecticides ever created. And to give you a sense of scale here, just 1 square foot of treated lawn with EPA-approved rates for neonics has enough active ingredient to kill 1 million bees. And since their introduction, neonics have made U.S. agriculture about 50 times more harmful to insect life. And again, we see that harmfulness spike almost exactly at the point where we see these mass losses of honeybees. So that's the first big problem. They're super duper toxic to insects. The second problem is that they're really good at contaminating whole ecosystems. Right. They're designed to permeate plants, to get into the leaves, the pollen, the root, the nectar, everything, and basically to make the plant itself toxic, to make the plant itself the pesticide. And that was a relatively new thing when neonics came on the scene. And it allows them to be applied in all sorts of new and interesting ways. They can be sprayed, and they are, but more commonly, they're literally painted on crop seeds, and that pesticide is sort of held there with microplastics. Mm. And the idea is, as that pesticide, the seed is growing into a plant, it literally is intended to soak up the pesticide coatings through its root and become toxic. The problem is only 2 to 5% of that coating gets into the target plant. The other 95%+ stays in the soil where it persists for years and years and years. And those same properties that let the neonics get into the plant means that they're very mobile in the environment. So anytime it rains, anytime there's lawn watering, those neonics are moving through the environment. They're contaminating new soil. If there's plants in that soil, they soak up the pesticides, they become toxic. If there's a water supply, that water supply becomes polluted. And then the last problem with neonics is that they are just all over the place. So virtually all conventional corn is pre-treated with a neonic on the seed. 50 to 75% of soybean, that's sort of the biggest uses, but they're also all over other agriculture, lawns, gardens, golf courses, bed bug products, pet products, you name it, they are everywhere.
Wow.
And what's happening is we're using these pesticides on a massive scale, maybe the largest deployment of an insecticide in U.S. history. We're using them in the same places year over year over year. We're getting a buildup of toxicity in the soil year over year because they're persistent.
Right.
And every time it rains, they are expanding into every nook and cranny of our ecosystem, soil, water, plant life, wildlife. Bottom line is that is very bad for bees. It's very bad for whole ecosystems. It's basically hollowing out our ecosystems from the bottom up with ripple effects to birds and fish, et cetera.
Right.
And these pesticides are also getting into our own bodies, and there's concerns for human health as well.
So are neonicotinoids active ingredients in off-the-shelf products? Got to go to the local department store and buy that?
Definitely. You can find neonics all over the place. So it's not going to say neonics on it, though.
Okay.
There are 5 neonic chemicals. I won't say them here. They're long and sort of wonky sounding. But every pesticide product is going to have a label. And so the only way to know if that product has a neonic in it is to know what the 5 chemical names are and cross-reference that with
right.
the label. But yes, you can pick them up at your Home Depot or Lowe's or your vet might prescribe some. Yeah, they're everywhere.
So what can be done for neonics? What can we do? How do we...
What are our options?
Yeah, what are our options, I guess, is a great way to say it.
So the good news is there are good options here. And I think, you know, Canada is sort of leading the way, but they're starting to... In the United States, I feel like the Canadian model is beginning to get picked up. But just to start in Europe was the first... jurisdiction to do something about neonic pollution. They had a partial ban of the three major neonic chemicals in 2013 and 2018. They sort of expanded it to all uses outdoors. And so that's been in place for a while, and they did that to protect bees. Canada almost did the same thing to protect aquatic ecosystems. They sort of backed off a little bit due to some industry pressure, but we've seen the provinces go a step further, and they've taken a different model, which is that if you want to use a neonic coating on a crop seed, and that's by far the largest use, right? By far the largest and most widespread use. You just have to show, you have to get a prescription from your agronomist that you're using that seed coating to address a legitimate pest problem. Because the secret is most of this use is wasteful, right? It's prophylactic. It's like taking an antibiotic now, just in case you might get sick in December.
Right.
And what it turns out is most of that use is not needed. So when folks had to get a prescription, we saw neonic use go from sort of ubiquitous on these seeds to almost nothing in the course of a couple of years without associated crop loss, without switching to more harmful alternatives. And so it's been a really successful model, and Quebec is actually expanding it. And we've seen that model adopted here in the United States. New York passed a law called the Birds and Bees Protection Act that did just that, and also had a ban on sort of the lawn and garden uses, which also aren't necessary.
Right.
And Vermont copied that. They did the same thing. And we've seen similar bills pop up across the country. Colorado actually just passed an incentive to have farmers switch from neonic treated seeds to non-neonic treated seeds. So we're beginning to see that level, that movement at the state level here in the United States too.
And if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Daniel Raykole, who is joining us to talk about bees on World Bee Day. Now, Daniel, we're talking about some of the detriments and things that are happening to our bee populations. And if you look at the outlook for our future, is it that bleak, or is there hope?
I mean, you know, it depends on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist.
Let's stay optimistic.
Let's stay optimistic. Well, I think things are so bad now, and people are aware of this issue that they're actually starting to do something. And again, we're starting to see that movement here at the state level in the U.S. We've seen other countries act. And I think, you know, when things get bad enough, people do tend to do something about it. And this, the good news here is that this is a problem that we can do something about. Neonics are persistent in the environment. They hang around for a while, but they're not forever chemicals, right? Mm-hmm. They do break down eventually. And the first rule of getting out of a hole is to stop digging. And I think we're starting to stop digging. Mm. So that's the hopeful case.
And that's hopeful, not just for the domestic bee world, but obviously anything we do to aid and help the domestic bees, honeybees, I'm sure we're also benefiting the native species of bees, like you say here in Utah is near 1,000 or so.
Yeah, what's good for honeybees is usually good for the rest of them, especially when it comes to toxics. And not just bees, right?
Right, right.
All insect life, I mean, what we have is this massive contamination of our environment, of this really, really potent insecticide. I mean, these chemicals are maybe the most ecologically destructive pesticides since DDT, maybe more in some ways. And bees are sort of, again, the canary in the coal mine. They're what we notice. They're what we pay attention to. And if we solve the problem for bees and other pollinators, we're going to be solving the problem for our ecosystems writ large.
And the ripple effect that this has, if you think about, we talked about at the beginning, our food sources, if there is food scarcity, everyone loses.
Right.
Well, and we already know from the studies that our fruit crops are already pollinator limited, right? Crops
yeah.
like apples, blueberries, cherries, we could be growing more of them if we had more pollinators. And it'll be interesting to see what happens this season, especially with the almond crop, which is sort of the most bee-intensive crop in the U.S. I mean, the numbers are so bad this year, and the whole system has sort of been held together with duct tape, right? But the numbers are so bad this year that it may start affecting production.
Right. And Speaking of almonds, that's a little tricky one too, because we also know almonds use a lot of water and they can be problematic in other ways. But I hear what you're saying. Why May 20th as National Bee Day?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure why they picked May 20th as World Bee Day.
I was just trying to think, was there a 520 something buzzing about May 20th or so? But what is the aim for National Bee Day?
World Bee Day.
I'm sorry, World Bee Day.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, this is global.
World Bee Day, yeah.
What is some of the goals? Education, advocacy, obviously.
Well, I think, you know, it's education, and I think, and I don't want to speak incorrectly here, but I think this sort of arose maybe after the mass losses of bees that we saw. And I think, you know, bees are a little bit more loved than other insects and maybe some of the other pollinators. But I think a lot of times, you know, people aren't thinking about bees or other bugs. And what we don't realize is their incredible importance, again, not just to the food that we eat, but also to our ecosystems and our natural world. So any awareness of that and any awareness of the really big problems that bees are facing right now and the ones that we can do something about, you know, that's the most important part of World Bee Day.
And one thing I add is always throw in a word for growing less grass. Kentucky bluegrass, lawn-based grass, because as one beekeeper told me, grass like that, that's flyover country for bees and other pollinators. There is nothing there for them except dandelions, which actually here out in Summit County in the months of April and May, a beekeeper told me, like, dandelions are the primary source of food, nectar or so, for honeybees because the other plants haven't blossomed yet. But yet, you know, we have it in for dandelions.
Embrace here. The dandelion. That's what I always say.
It's a great source of food, a nectar and pollen for, among other things, both honeybees and native bees, too. But my point, Daniel, was the less grass we grow and the more native species, native grasses or other shrubs, the better for bees and other butterflies and all those pollinator species. Mm.
Well, definitely. And that's the other half. I mean, toxics are a big issue, but so is habitat. I mean, bees are a lot like us. They need food, they need shelter, and they need it to be clean, right? They need it to be, you know, not full of toxic pesticides. So one of the best things that people can do on their own lawn and their own property is grow more native plants that flower, you know, and that doesn't include, you know, grass. But yeah, grow those native plants, the ones that are native to your region that are flowering, and don't use pesticides on your lawn. Especially don't use neonics, because that's going to have sort of the opposite effect, right? We don't want to attract bees to flowers that have toxic pollen.
And just to be clear, neonicotinoids are active ingredients in many, like you say, off-the-shelf insecticides. That's totally different from something like Roundup, which has the active ingredient of glyphosate. So that's yet another issue that we need to avoid too, but I wanna make sure our listeners understand the difference.
Yeah, there is a difference. And so the big one in to keep in your mind is glyphosates are herbicides. They're designed to kill plants.
Yes.
And neonics are insecticides. They're designed to kill insects. And that's why they're so much more potent. I mean, these things are harmful at parts per trillion. That's not to say that glyphosate doesn't have toxic impacts too,
right?
But it's just the neonics are so much more toxic at really minuscule concentrations. That's why they're such a problem.
And again, they sound indiscriminate. Pollinators or otherwise, ants, earthworms, they're all going to get infected or take up neonicotinoids. Am I right?
So the name neonicotinoid is new nicotine-like substance. They actually mimic nicotine. And the nerves that they target are very well distributed in insect bodies across the board. So they're harmful across the spectrum. But the other thing to note, too, is our nerves also respond to nicotine, too.
Right?
So there's toxicity concerns for people as well. They're just broadly harmful.
Well, hopefully we will be moving in the right direction. And we always, we know that things can get heavy here. So we always do try to stay hopeful. Well, and we love to educate people and ourselves around some of the things that we're using that could be toxic or ways in which the keystone species in our world we have to pay more attention to, bees being one of them.
Yeah, and I think there's more backyard mindfulness going on with respect to pulling up our grass, growing more native plants, like you say, annual flowering species, et cetera. So we're hopeful there.
We are hopeful. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. We appreciate you being on our show. Daniel Raquel, who is the acting director of the Pollinator Initiative at the National Resources Defense Council. We appreciate you joining us here on World Bee Day.
Thanks, Daniel.
Yep. Thanks again for having me.
And joining us for the second part of the show is journalist Chris Burdick. Among other things, he has written a new book. He's penned a new book titled Clamor, How Noise Took Over the World and How We Can Take It Back. Chris Burdick, thank you so much for joining Claire and myself on This Green Earth.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, we start with some definition of terms and stuff like that. I thought a way of doing that is the following. I was walking my dog this morning, and obviously I took a heightened awareness of the sounds, quote-unquote sounds, around me. And they included the following, Chris. The morning chorus of sparrows and house finches and chickadees going about their morning business, etc. The morning chorus of the pickleballers, who I have a couple of courts near me, and I get to hear the sounds emitted by a plastic paddle hitting a plastic ball, and then the accompanying screaming and commiserating that go with seemingly every point. I'll stop my opinion section there. But also the sound of distance sandhill cranes, who have a very loud call, which can carry almost a half a mile. And finally, the jackhammer that is banging away at the local construction site. So, Chris, all of these are defined, you know, in terms of physics as sounds, right? The propagation of waves through the air, pressure waves through the air. But some of them, we consider them, you know, pleasant. Finches, sparrows, chickadees. Some not so pleasant / objectionable. Plastic paddle on plastic ball. Can you help us define where that line is? And I know the answer is probably going to be something like depends, but how do we define what is a kind of a sound and what becomes a, in a sense, a noise, or in your word, clamor?
Well, that's a great question.
I know,
and the answer is it depends, but I'll do my best.
You have 20 minutes. Yeah. Go ahead.
Traditionally, we have measured it in terms of decibels.
Right.
This is a certain decibel level means this noise is problematic. Below it, okay, we're in the clear. And obviously, as you point out, that doesn't work. You've got, you know, the cranes that are very loud. If you were next to one, I'm sure, quite loud. As you've got pickleballs, which can be loud, but you know, they're not going to hurt your hearing.
No.
You have to have different pieces of context that you use to judge when a sound becomes noise. And obviously, there's a lot of subjectivity, but I don't think it's an arbitrary thing. I think our judgment of noise is based on, you know, our personal likes, dislikes, our cultural backgrounds, the mood that we're in. But I think there's a lot that unites us as humans. I'll stick with the human piece first, in terms of how our inner ear anatomy is sensitive to certain decibels, how our hearing is hooked into kind of a lightning fast connection with our stress response, our sort of fight or flight response to our very, you know, expansive, but you know, ultimately limited ability to handle a certain number of signals at any given point. You know, these are all things that are uniting us when we are experiencing different sounds. And, you know, context matters quite a bit. If you are at a restaurant and you are surrounded by conversation and, you know, some music, some clattering of dishes, all those sounds are probably fine with you until they are too many signals for you to actually have a conversation with somebody. Then they become noise. You know, in your office, it's actually kind of sometimes good to have some background churn of sound, as long as it's not intelligible. If it gets too quiet and you can hear every half conversation of every coworker on their cell phone talking about their weekend, it may be fairly low decibel. It may be otherwise quiet, but that is going to, your brain is going to latch on to that voice because it, you can understand it. That becomes noise. Yeah. So there are all these different factors that come to play.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you mentioned the office sounds, because when I worked in an office in kind of a sea of cubicles, you're right, when there was a low-level collection of sounds that I couldn't focus on any one conversation, but maybe a number of quiet conversations or people rustling papers, there was almost what I'll call it an ASMR effect that was induced, audio stimulated meridional response. I like to refer to it as a warm chill that comes over you, and it's really, really extremely pleasant. But that is at a low volume, like you say. If it got louder and louder, then it's something else entirely. I also think that that dissonance plays a role in defining the difference between what's pleasant and what might be objectionable. Because I could play Mozart and Debussy at a loud volume and still enjoy it. Conversely, I could play Arnold Schoenberg or Paul Hindemith at a very low level volume, and it's still dissonant and objectionable to me. So is that right? Is like the quality of the sound or the dissonant nature of sound can also be disruptive?
It can be. I mean, you start sliding into a question of sort of personal taste.
Yes.
And in that manner, I don't know a ton of research that pertains to it. And certainly at a certain decibel level, whether you're listening to your favorite song or one that you hate, it's still going to hurt your hearing. That won't really matter. But at a lower level, it does matter. There are some sort of what we would call psychoacoustic qualities to certain sounds. They would say, you know, is it very tonal? So that tonal might be like a high-pitched whine, a very sort of constant frequency, either very high pitched or very low pitched, the kind of thing that you feel in your chest. People don't like tonal sounds very much at all. There's other things like roughness. That's if you have a lot of high energy going back and forth between high and low frequencies. These are things that I'm not going to imitate a rough sound for you, but if you look that up, those are also things that kind of grate on people. So there are, you know, many acoustic particulars that you could call dissonance that play into whether or not you will perceive a sound positively or negatively.
Right, like nails across a chalkboard, no matter what the volume is, that's disturbing. Okay.
Yeah.
Chris, I'm curious what set you on the path to get into this and to write Clamor. And as I understand it, you began the book before COVID, and how did COVID affect your understanding of soundscapes? As we think of landscapes, a lot of people pull this up in their mind's eye, but when we think of soundscapes, it's a little bit different. So can you walk us through that?
Yeah, happy to. Yeah, it began before COVID. As you say, I did a magazine feature for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine about a public health researcher here in Boston who was focused on noise. And at first, I was just really fascinated by this idea. I read all this epidemiology showing how noise exposure increases the risk of cardiovascular disease and hypertension and can impact the brain development and has, you know, obviously disturbing our sleep and hurting our mental well-being. All of these major public health impacts from a source that nobody could really define. And so that kind of got me started on digging into it. I wrote a few more magazine stories about restaurant noise, about noise in nature, and got this book contract right at the end of 2019. And I had prepared to go out and interview people. I was in touch with researchers. I was in touch with people that were dealing with noise from various sources. And then the pandemic hit, which made me, which basically put everything on ice. That's the short answer. While I was sitting there, I had a 18-month extension on the book, and I started to think a lot about what this book should be, and it gave me the time to do that. And as you recall, one of the side effects of everybody staying home and cities shutting down and really all the catastrophic aspects of COVID was quiet. You know, people heard birds, people, you know, noticed that there were not so many cars and trucks driving around. Mm-hmm. And I think when people measured it, when scientists measured this in places, they found about four to six decibels reduced in sort of the ambient noise levels. And I thought, well, this is interesting because here we have a quieter world, which is what a lot of people who are in the anti-noise movement would say they want. But you couldn't escape what it took to get there. You couldn't escape the sort of shutting down of economies, the sickness, the fear. You couldn't kind of shake that. And so I think my take on that was, well, let's think a lot more about what we actually want when we are fighting noise. What is our end game here? And it's not that quiet is bad. I think quiet is precious and it's worth protecting. But to have it be the only thing that we care about, it just felt a little hollow to me. It felt like, well, let's think more about the places that we're building, the cities that we're creating, and can we think about how sound can support the goals that we have for those places? You know, to have sound be not just the noise that we complain about after the fact, but something that we think about and we can either avoid or use, you know, the sounds to our advantage if we think broadly enough.
How is the world getting noisier over the decades? What are the new and unusual sources of sounds in our daily lives?
Right. Well, I mean, I would start with just the math of it all. And if we have more and more people living in closer proximity using not just new sound producing stuff, but all the old sound producing stuff as well, that is going to have an inevitable impact on our soundscapes. I think, you know, there have been many additional sources of sound. I write a newsletter, and one of the things I wrote about recently were data centers, where, you know, it's one of the biggest pieces of commercial building out there. You know, my wife is in construction, so she knows that that's where the money is now going to build these data centers to handle all of our internet traffic, and especially with the AI and the cryptocurrencies. And these places make noise. They inside are so loud because you have to cool the servers or else the whole thing melts down. Right. And this takes a lot of air movement and a lot of HVAC, and all these places need to have backup generators just in case. So this noise inside, you need to have hearing protection, but outside it's not so loud. It wouldn't violate any municipal noise code.
Right.
Maybe it might be, you know, 60 decibels, 65 decibels, kind of the same level that the FAA will pay to insulate your house if you're getting a flyover from jets at that level. But it's low decibel, so you feel it, you don't just hear it, and it goes on all the time. It never stops. And so that is, you know, just an example of like a new noise source. I also make the case that, you know, a lot of noise that bothers us is not the loudest, it's the most disruptive, it's the most distracting. And in that sense, all of our overstuffed inboxes, all of our social media scrolls, all the notifications and the sort of online cacophony that we've set up for ourselves, some of it is audible because you get those little dings and chimes and rings, but some of it is not. But it's all sort of unwanted signals that your mind has to sift through. And that accumulates. It's exhausting, just like the audible variety. So these are all pieces of what makes the world noisier now. And I'll just add one more thing, which is this kind of sonic short-sightedness, I'll call it, where we've traditionally not thought about sound as we, or at least not thought about it beyond a decibel threshold as we build our buildings, as we design our cities. Noise is just something that we regret in hindsight more than anything else. And so that's been a problem. It's exacerbated, I think, the noise issue all the way around.
We're speaking with journalist Chris Burdick. He has penned a new book titled Clamor: How Noise Took Over the World and How We Can Take It Back. So let's now kind of focus on the second half of that title, How We Take It Back. You kind of touched on or alluded to a couple, you know, that we seek quiet. We're fortunate enough out here in Park City, Utah, that we can get away from noise. It's not a very noisy place to begin with, honestly, relatively speaking, but we can always take a hike and be surrounded by natural sounds, not necessarily silence, although silence has its own benefits too, but the natural sounds and the sounds of the natural world. What about those, like you say, who work in very, you know, densely populated urban settings? What are their options to reduce the amount of clamor they're subjected to?
Yeah, sure. And I'll start small, which is, I think we could do a much better job of protecting our ears. I never really thought about it before I started researching this book, but I now have a large collection of the sort of foamy ones that you sort of smush into your ears when you're using a power tool or mowing the lawn, snow blowing. I never did that before, but now I do. And I also have slightly more expensive, not very expensive, maybe $20 a pair, maybe $40 a pair if you get the really good ones. They're called musicians' earplugs. And what they do, what's nice, is that they, instead of blocking just the higher frequencies, which is kind of what the foamies do, they take maybe a 10 decibel cut off of every frequency all the way down so that you hear everything clearly. If you want to go to a concert, you can still hear the music just as you would. It just takes the edge off a bit. So I think, you know, people don't consider hearing until it starts to slip away. And there's been some research into kind of how many people will protect their hearing outside of, the noisy industries where it's not required that they do it, but they do have the hearing protection offered to workers. And it's not very many, but I think that's changing. I think that people, you'll see in the crowds at sporting events, you know, people will put the protection over the hearing protection over their kids' ears. In music, now every musician of note will have in-ear device that is protecting their hearing as well as kind of streaming in the sound that they need to hear. That was unheard of 30 years ago. And I think, you know, gradually protecting our hearing is changing in a sort of social norm sort of way rather than, you know, any sort of heavy-handed requirements and regulations, which I think is necessary because fixing things by regulation, I think regulations have their place, but it can be kind of a brittle fix. So that's one thing. I think there is a way to harness our power as consumers to not just complain about noise, but to reward products and services and businesses that take the soundscape seriously. The app that I like to recommend is called Soundprint, and it's a crowdsourced app. It was started by a guy in New York who he has a bit of a hearing difficulty, and he found that he was trying to go on dates and he couldn't have conversations with his dates in most of the restaurants in Manhattan. So he said, you know, let's come up with a list of quieter venues where people can actually talk to each other, and let's have everybody get access to that list and be able to add to that list. And so it's become this worldwide phenomenon where you can go into the app and sort of find places that are quiet. It will have the decibel rating. It'll have some information about the place, and also have places to kind of warn people against, or, you know, maybe say, hey, if you're looking for a place that'll blow your doors off, you know, here's one. So that's, I think, those are a couple ways.
I love that invention, or I love the idea of apps.
It's called Sound Print, like
Sound
a thumbprint.
Okay. Sound Print.
I couldn't hear. Sorry.
We've already lost it. Yeah. I've been to too many concerts in my day, but I will say that my friend had an app that he would hold up to different, you know, in settings. I was in Vietnam and there was karaoke going on and we were like, it is really extremely loud.
Yeah.
And held up the app and it was at that decibel that can injure or harm you.
Sure.
And your hearing. So I think people are coming up with ways that we can understand better at what level that is happening and that we can better protect ourselves. Like I mentioned before, when you say landscape and you think about when you define a place or you look into a place or you want to go to a place, you really define it by the landscape. But now we are leaning into, you're also defining it by its soundscape. So do you find that in writing this that people were already maybe even more aware than you had thought about what was happening, or did you think that you're bringing this to light now?
Yeah, I was finding awareness all over the place, which was great. You know, my hope is that I'm showing people who are thinking about the soundscape in restaurants that they actually have a lot in common with the people that are thinking about the soundscape in hospitals, and that those people have a lot in common with the people that are worried about the soundscape in offices. You know, when I was doing this reporting, I saw all these new devices that were coming out that, you know, used to be, and still is, I think, a real stigma to have a hearing aid. You know, that's something that old people get, and it mm-hmm. looks like, you know, it's very, you know, prescription medical looking, and
right.
We don't want it. But now there are so many devices that will augment your ability to listen to somebody in a noisy place. You can adjust how much sound you're getting from sort of the ambient sources. And these are wildly popular. You know, the Apple Watch, in addition, has, you know, a decibel tracker that will kind of keep tabs on, you know, how loud things are, where you're going, and it's part of its sort of health suite. You know, people are interested in sort of knowing what they're exposing themselves to, and these devices are a big part of that, and they're popular and in demand.
Well, just a couple minutes along those lines, noise-canceling headphones, thoughts about them?
Oh, I think they're great.
Okay.
I mean, no. So I'll expand basically. I talked to one of the pioneers at Bose who worked on those, the first consumer pair of those in around 2000. And what was great was that, you know, he thought a lot about, you know, as this product was becoming more and more popular, it was really focusing on creating a kind of sonic sanctuary where we could kind of keep out everything basically and just listen to our music, let's say, or just keep out everything. And he thought, you know, what if we could use the same sort of technology to help us connect with one another? If we could somehow noise cancel the right things and boost the things that we wanted to hear, wouldn't that be something? And he was able to come up with a kind of a prototype sort of device called the Hearphones, which came out, I can't give you the date on that, but they were just a prototype and they were sort of limited circulation. But that idea has now been adopted widely by Apple and others to use noise canceling, not just to kind of shut everybody out, but to help bring people together. And I think that's great.
Well, the book is called Clamor, How Noise Took Over the World and How We Can Take It Back. It is extensive. You've done so much research on this. Yeah. Very interesting and fascinating. Thanks. Read.
Well, thank you so much for having me.